This morning I'm going to start with a reading, and I know I don't do this a lot, but I just thought it was really good, so there you go. This is a reading that was an op-ed in the New York Times called The Charitable Industrial Complex. It's by Peter Buffett, who is Warren Buffett's son, and thus. Early on in our pilgrimage or philanthropic journey, my wife and I became aware of something I started to call the philanthropic colonialism. I noticed that a donor had the urge to save the day in some fashion. People, including me, who had very little knowledge of a particular place, would think that they could solve every local problem, whether it involved farming methods, education practices, job training, or business development. Over and over, I would hear people discuss transplanting what worked in one setting directly into another with little regard for culture, geography, or societal norms. Often the results of our decisions had unintended consequences. For example, distributing condoms to stop the spread of AIDS in a brothel area ended up creating a higher price for unprotected sex. But now I think something even more damaging is going on because of who my father is, Warren Buffett. I've been able to occupy some seats I never expected to sit in. Inside any important philanthropy meeting, you witness heads of state meeting with investment managers and corporate leaders. All are searching for answers with their right hand to problems that others in the rooms have created with their left hand. With $316 billion being given away, philanthropy has become the it vehicle to level the playing field and has generated a growing number of gatherings, workshops, and affinity groups. As more lives and communities are destroyed by the system that creates vast amounts of wealth for the few, the more heroic in it tries to give back. It's what I called conscious laundering. Feeling better about accumulating more than any one person could possibly need to live on by sprinkling a little around as an act of charity. But this just keeps the existing structure of inequality in place. The rich sleep better at night, while others get just enough to keep the pot from boiling over. Nearly every time someone feels better by doing good on the other side of the world or street, someone else is further locked into a system that will not allow the true flourishing of his or her nature or the opportunity to live a joyful and fulfilled life. And with more business-minded folks getting into the act, business principles are trumpeted as important element to the ad of the philanthropic sector. I now hear people ask, what's the ROI when it comes to alleviating human suffering? As if return on investment were the only measure of success. Microlending and financial literacy, what is this really all about? People will certainly learn how to integrate into our system of debt and payment, repayment with interest. People will rise above making $2 a day to enter our world of goods and services so they can buy more. But doesn't all this just feed the beast? I'm not really calling for an end to capitalism. I'm calling for humanism. T.S. Eliot once shared that most of the evil in this world is done by people with good intentions. How can we ever do good works in the world if we are forever concerned about the implications of our actions? Is it not possible to know how far-reaching or what consequences come with our well-intentioned actions? But unfortunately, we can't know. And the truth of it is, we cannot let it deter us, because truthfully, we should act. The key to taking action is to come from a place of love and to remain mindful. This morning, I wanted to have an opportunity to wonder about one thing, blessings. Many of us live amazing lives that include such outrageous fortune as clean drinking water, sanitation, grocery stores where we can walk in and get bananas or pineapples from Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean at any time of the day, night, or year. We have clean hospitals if we get hurt or sick, and more than not, our streets are fairly safe. We have cars and gas and air conditioning. We have a fairly secure future. And if something doesn't quite go as planned, we have insurance to cover us for the just in case. How blessed are we? I mean, really. Maybe we have worries, but it seems in large measure our survival is fairly secured. With this said, we're not all that far away from those who struggle. We know who they are. They frequent the food pantries and soup kitchens and live in motels because they have lost their jobs, their homes, their security. Most of us otherize them because it helps us to get some distance from the bad luck of loss or disease or disaster. One may wonder if it's bad luck, irresponsibility, lack of privilege or education. And yet, I read somewhere at some point that for most of us, we're only one catastrophic illness away from homelessness. But that's kind of beside the point, really. Many of us already know this fact. However, if you're anything like me, you avert your eyes from the truth of this and hope that your health cooperates and that the fates shine positively, and that all will work out. One only has to look at the biblical story of Job and think, poor Job. He must have done something really wrong to upset God. Well, at least that's what all of his friends thought as Job sat ruined on an ash heap before his misfortune. Job had it all, the family, the sheep, the land, the home, a loving wife. God and Satan conspired against Job's faith, and as a test of sorts, took everything that he had away from him. And Job still refused to curse God or call for a reckoning. Picture Job sitting on the ash heap, wondering what has hit him, basically. He's lost everything except for his wife. Albeit she's not sitting on that ash heap with him. She must have been at her mother-in-law's or someplace else. But then, as if cued, Job's wife entered stage left, coming to visit him. She takes one look at him, poor guy, sitting on this ash heap covered in boils, and says, "Do you still persist in your integrity? Curse God and die!" Wow. Now that is slightly harsh. That's all she says to him, and basically she just exits stage right. Here's the interesting thing. Job isn't a them to us, because the story is written in such a way that we can relate to Job, and thus we see ourselves in his plight in some ways. What does Job do? He basically accepts his current position on that ash heap, and then he realizes he needs to know why this has happened. And he actually goes out and challenges God and calls for a reckoning. Why? In response, God takes Job on a journey of discovery where he realizes that he cannot know it all, nor can he control it all. Power and privilege are fleeting. Job realizes that all the good deeds and sacrificing cannot secure one's future, at which point he prays for his friends, those same friends that doubted him and condemned him. Job is just a good guy. And God sees this and decides to restore everything to him threefold. The lesson learned in this ancient story: bad things can happen to good people. Keep the faith and absolutely expect and do ask why. The story of Job and all of the experiences that we have had around loss remind us how temporary and tenuous life can be. I have to admit that in this moment of blissful ignorance, I feel blessed. And yet I know that even in this meeting house, there are those of us who struggle and do not feel blessed. How can there be peace in the world when there's not peace in our hearts? I worry about those who do not have peace in their hearts, those who struggle and have less than. I want to do what I can to help make the world a better place for all of us, even those who are not my kin or are in my tribe. Some would consider me nothing but a do-gooder. So I wonder, what is the natural tendency of a do-gooder? To reach out and help, to share the wealth, to call for justice, to point out and work to alleviate injustice. I truly believe that as Unitarian Universalists or any conscious human beings on this planet, we have a moral obligation to do good in the world. Maybe I'm more than blissfully ignorant. Maybe I'm just naive. Or not. I choose to believe that given the choice and opportunity, people will do the right thing. What is the right thing, and how can we possibly know? Well, of course, there was a study done. At the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, where people were evaluated with regard to, of all things, whistleblowing, because that seems to be the closest measurable action of doing the right thing, is blowing the whistle. It was realized that there are two values, fairness and loyalty, that were in tension with regard to whistleblowing. Loyalty and fairness. What the researchers uncovered was that these two values compel people to either stand by and watch injustice or take action. Although fairness and loyalty are both basic moral values, some people prioritize one over the other, fairness or loyalty. Studies show that American liberals, this I find daunting, tend to focus more on fairness, while American conservatives tend to focus more on loyalty. Isn't that interesting? And it explains a lot, actually. Where do we learn these moral lessons about fairness and loyalty? Most likely at home, on the playground, and of course, in religious community. Can any of you remember ever, or even the last time, that loyalty was preached from this pulpit? Loyalty. I'm not hearing it. Okay. In most of the world's religions, it seems that the practice of compassion, generosity, and the doing of good deeds is considered a basic and necessary practice of advancement to heaven or nirvana. Fairness can be found in the Old and New Testaments. References are found in every single gospel as well as in Proverbs. So here's one for you. 31:9. Open your mouth. Judge righteously. Defend the rights of the poor and needy. And in regard to loyalty, I turn to the Ten Commandments. The second one specifically. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Clear and straight to the point. Be loyal or else. Poor Job. Seeing the inequality in the world compels us to do the right thing. And it is the desire for fairness and our commitment to loyalty that propels us to act or not. The real question to my mind is, are we so blessed in this life that we do not even see or become affected by the inequality in this world? This morning's sermon is about blessings, the ones that we realize and acknowledge, and those that we do not even realize that are at our disposal, such as the color of our skin, or the luck of our birth, or the ability to break through that glass ceiling in business because of our gender or affiliations, to name just a few advantages. This morning's sermon is also about being mindful of these blessings that we do have, the earned and unearned privilege and the advantage of position. It is also about how important it is that we learn to stop using language that separates us one from the other. As long as there is separation between us and them, there will never be peace. There will always be unrest. Take a look at Gaza. Tribe and kin, fairness or loyalty. If you are not with us, you're against us. Truth be told, we even do this in our community. There are those among us who have been members for 20, 30, 40 years and more. And I'm going to need you to be bold, be daring, be a truth teller. How many of us feel like outsiders? Thank you, Chris. A few of us, right? Why? Why is this? It's not because we're not welcoming, because we are. What I would recommend that we begin to look at welcoming, and we invite one another in. Go beyond. Because invite them truly in that inner circle. And then expand out that circle and welcome in the complete and total stranger. When our inner circle includes everyone, that is where the blessings of this community, in this building, and out there. I think of the selectmen, for example. When you start to welcome people into your inner circle, you will have civility. And you will truly be realized. And our souls will all be fed. And finally, this morning's sermon is about opening our minds. I mean, truly opening our minds. Suspending the judgment of righteousness referred to in Proverbs. And instead, begin to accept and love wholeheartedly. Without an open mind, we can never have an open heart. I'm trying to learn how to do this right now in my own life, as a matter of fact. And it isn't easy. It really isn't easy. Because when I was little, my mother taught me that one could only really trust and depend on their family. Expect that only their family could be there when the going got tough. You see, that's what her mother had taught her, and her grandmother taught her mother. I'm wondering, am I the only one that ever heard that from their parents? You see, this concept of us and them has been planted within us early on and is continually reinforced through the binds that tie. And frankly, it's insidious. It begins early. The separating and differentiating, it makes some insiders and others outsiders. How can there be peace in the world unless there's peace in our hearts? And how can there be peace in our hearts unless we are all part of the same tribe? We're all kin. And even if we are all kin, and those who have brothers and sisters can attest, you still struggle with one another. Why? Why is that? Power, control, and ego, says one of my closest friends. It's all about power, control, and ego, Marjorie. Tell them that. It's all about power, control, and ego. Done. Or maybe, I look back at her and said, it's about fear of loss of power and control, which affects our ego. Subtle, but different. Peter Buffett shared in his op-ed, I'm really not calling for an end to capitalism, I'm calling for humanism. What might that shift look like? Defined, humanism is said to be an outlook or system of thought attaching prime importance to human rather than divine or supernatural matters. Humanist beliefs stress the potential value and goodness of human beings, emphasize common human needs, and seek solely rational ways of solving human problems. Believe it or not, there is actually a UU Humanist Association who are self-proclaimed naturalists. They share that although we do not consider humanism to be a religion, within the widespread use of the term to denote beliefs and practices resting on some hypothetical supernatural entity, we are religious, and that we share with most Unitarian Universalists the natural human desire for a beloved and accepting community, a purpose greater than ourselves, rituals and practices that resonate with our common humanity and shared mortality, and opportunities to work with other tough-minded, warm-hearted people to do good in the world and to help one another attain the greatest possible fulfillment in life. There it is again, to do good in the world. In writing my dissertation for my doctorate, I shared that to do good in the world is of primary human concern. This premise is far older than my dissertation, of course. I referred to Aristotle, who explained in the opening line of Nicomachean Ethics, every art and every inquiry, and similarly every action and pursuit, is thought to aim at some good. And for this reason, the good has rightly been declared to be that at which all things aim. Aristotle's good. Is this what seekers have been endeavoring to find and create throughout history? Ultimately, I believe that it is not actually the good that we seek, listen to me going up against Aristotle, to create, but we actually want to create connection and affirmation. If we do good, will we be welcomed in? That is the real question. With this promise revealed, I wonder if our aim might be to engage in any endeavor that helps us to connect one of us to the other. Thus, basic things such as the language of us and them, the haves and the have-nots, must be discarded. We are all one species that is endeavoring to survive. Do we help or do we hinder the other? Fairness or loyalty? It's a hard and complex question to be certain. What is of primary import is to understand that it is what it is like to be the other. And I think that is what Job could not understand before he was sitting on that ash heap. He didn't know what it was like. So here is one way that I personally thought about being the other and how my perspective has changed by having the opportunity to step over and to experience what life might be like, albeit temporary. How many of you have broken a bone or had surgery that took you from being able-bodied to temporarily disabled? Quite a few, right? Me too. You're once whole and capable, and then in an instant, you are not. You went from being us, the able-bodied, to being one of them, the disabled. How did that feel? For me, it was frustrating. I couldn't do for myself, but I tolerated because I was clearly in a temporary condition. However, one has the opportunity to realize just how difficult getting around is when you're in this situation, how high that curb really is to step over, and how much help is required to do the simplest of things, just like sitting up in bed. My mindset was temporarily shifted. How about yours? All of a sudden, you were like, holy moly. And then you got better. You healed. And I wonder if you think about those people who are truly permanently disabled, that live in a place that we just visited. Not being in pain is a blessing. This is just one example. There are many on this planet who do not have the luxury, in many cases, unearned privilege that those of us in this room have. My friends, we are blessed. Even on a bad day, we have education, in most cases, with a loving family, access to position, power, the ability to insure and borrow, to buy a home, have children, and again, in most cases, give them the same quality of life you had or better. We are blessed. This morning, I've certainly given us a lot to think about. And this month, I'm asking that we take the time to really realize our blessings and to be mindful of the non-tangible cost of each and every single one of them. Where do these blessings come from? Who do they affect? And what are the implications of our do-gooder generosity in the world as we try to share our blessings with others? Another thought to consider, how do the blessings that we have separate us one from another? And finally, can the world know peace in such desperate difference in affluence and living conditions? I'm not asking that we give it all up and build a commune, although there's probably some in here that would. I'm asking us to be mindful of our privilege and to use that privilege while we are able to do good in the world, to build bridges instead of fences, to open our minds in order to open our hearts, to wonder about the differences that exist between fairness and loyalty, and to be ever mindful that today we are able-bodied. But as with Job, tomorrow things might not turn out exactly as we expect. I want to just take a second and thank the powers that be in this universe. Let us thank God, or call that animating energy the spirit of life and love, for all the fortune that has shined upon us. And in that same breath, let us be thankful for the challenges and the opportunities that we are faced with. Rumi, the 13th century Sufi poet, said it best, as far as I'm concerned. This being human is a guest house. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. For this we pray. Blessed be. Amen.